closer toward you. As we were discussing before, I thought today what we could discuss were some of basically the firms you were involved with through your various venture capital endeavors starting in the late 60s, mainly out of that packet of documents that you sent. And so what I tried to do in reviewing those documents was, to the best that I could, you know, get a kind of a grouping of these firms in a roughly chronological order. And my thought was that we could just go through the names of these firms and just talk about your major recollections of them and your involvement with them, how things turned out for them, the story of each of these firms, if you will. So one that I saw in the first group, which I guess is the Geiger-Fialkov group, was a company called Signalite from New Jersey. I was wondering if you could tell us whatever you might remember about that firm.
Signalite was not a venture type of a thing. It was a company that I acquired for General Instrument.
Oh.
When I was a senior vice president for making business acquisitions.
Yeah.
And Signalite was a company that manufactured neon bulbs.
Okay.
And they were making money. They were in the west coast of New Jersey. I'm trying to remember the town. And there was, it was not a major acquisition. I think we acquired it for a couple of $1 million. And it just added components not to the semiconductor operation.
This but to
was
the general.
After I was out of semiconductors and just making acquisitions for the company. So it was a small acquisition. And it kept being small. Never grew into anything large. What I remember most about Signalite is that the fellow who was a partner who got 50% of what we paid, ultimately he continued to work for the company. And ultimately gambled his money away. And one Sunday morning, he sat down on a piano bench and shot himself in the head.
Oh my gosh, after losing everything to gambling.
After losing everything, yeah. The story was, that time in New Jersey, there was a meeting of a group of neurosurgeons at the local hospital. They operated on him, and they saved him.
Oh my God.
What was he like after that?
After that, Monte Shapiro, who was the chief executive, talked to the gamblers, and he got them off the debt, and the fellow became an investor in Geiger-Fialkov.
So he not only did he live, but he didn't lose mental faculties or anything like that in any substantial way.
That's right.
That's amazing.
It must have gone this way. And whatever was damaged recovered. Something like a the Pasha Lombardo.
One of the other firms that I saw list, or that I saw in the documentation, that seemed very like a very different sort of a thing was something called Electronic Wholesalers, that was run out of Miami, Florida.
It was one of the first investments that Guy Gonfialco made. It was very successful southeastern wholesaler of electronic products. We changed the name ultimately to Agora Industries because we wanted to make acquisitions, and it became public. And I became chairman. But we ultimately sold it to Kramer Electronics.
Kramer Electronics.
Which was in New England, major New England distributor. And there's a similar story there, because the top executives of the company, including the fellow who ran Electronic Wholesalers, were meeting in a hotel in Rye, New York. And the hotel caught fire. The fellow from Electronic Wholesalers was killed. Another crazy story. But it was a major fire. Kramer Electronics was ultimately sold to Arrow.
To whom?
Arrow Electronics.
Oh, to Arrow Electronics. Now I'm familiar with them.
They're a major company. But this was in the business of distributing components, including semiconductors, you know, which brought me to Electronic Wholesalers in the first place.
Had they been a distributor of your parts?
I don't remember.
Yeah, but you were familiar with the whole...
Yeah, I was familiar with what they were doing. I liked it, and I thought it would be an interesting investment. And that's how it turned out.
Was the...
I probably still have a stock certificate of Electronic Wholesalers made out to Guy Gonfialco. Someplace in my historic stock certificate that was one that was left over and never exchanged to Kramer. Because by the time the merger took place, there was no Geiger and Fialco. You know, we already distributed everything.
Right. What's the idea?
Two strange stories.
Yeah, it's funny that I picked those two at random to begin with. Was when you changed it from Electronic Wholesalers to Agora Industries in order to make acquisitions, was this buying up other component distributors?
We thought that once we were a public company, we could enlarge it and become larger. But it turned out that we got involved in different ventures, and we let that one be sold to Kramer. It was a good sale, you know, it was a profitable sale.
And Kramer itself was an electronics components
distributor.
Yeah. In a similarly named, I saw that there was a company called Pharmaceutical Wholesalers that was based in
Long Island.
What was that?
Pharmaceutical Wholesalers was a fellow who had a business selling. Generic pharmaceutical. And he didn't manufacture them. He sold them. And some of them were the pharmaceuticals that required, you know, they were pharmaceuticals that required, you know, prescriptions for sale. And they got into some sort of trouble, legal trouble. And I really don't remember what happened to them. But I don't remember that it turned out to be a successful venture.
What led you to make that investment? Why did you make that investment?
How we were already invested in distributors.
Okay.
This was a local one, right. And they were profitable.
At that time.
And we thought, you know, generic pharmaceuticals would go a long way.
Right.
And it did. Become, I guess the major company is an Israeli company called Teva.
Right, today.
Today. But we recognize it as a major future potential,
right.
And we thought, let's get involved.
Only this guy didn't turn out to be the right one.
It didn't turn out to be the right one. He was sued by a competitor. And it turns out that he was selling some of these pharmaceuticals without the proper authorization.
What years were those? What time frame was that?
If it was Geiger and Fianca, it was somewhere between 1968 and 78.
Yeah.
That's really before Hatch-Waxman, 1984. And that's when the generic drug industry really took off after 84. So this was really...
We tried to get in early.
Yeah, yeah. Real early.
But you got in with a fellow who wasn't doing everything on the dotted line.
Well, things may have loosened up a little bit later, too. That would have made it a little easier.
He had to check to whom that he was selling it only to a pharmacist.
Oh.
And he wasn't that careful.
Another company that I saw that was also based on Long Island was called Lisa Monet Incorporated. Couldn't find anything out about that firm.
Did we invest in Lisa Monet?
I believe so. Well, I believe you were on its board of directors, so I assumed perhaps you had been invited to participate. It was from the Geiger-Fialkov era.
What did they do?
I couldn't figure it out. I looked on, it eluded me in my research.
It was one of the things I resigned from?
It was indeed. Also based in Plainview.
I'm drawing a blank.
A firm that was perhaps related to Agora Industries that I saw that was based in Miami, Florida, was something called 21st Century Electronics.
21st Century Electronics is a subsidiary of Electronic Wholesale.
Okay.
I think it was just one of their locations.
Uh-huh. Another company called Slant Fin Corporation from Greenvale, New York, seemed to be more in the industrial line of things.
Slant Fin was a personal investment. When I left General Instrument, Slant Fin was a company whose major product line was radiators for the home. You know, baseboard radiators.
Right.
They also made boilers. They added boilers. It was a very successful company. and I invested in it. I took a personal, substantial position in it. This is before I went into venture capital. When I left General Instrument, he provided me with an office. In other words, I had an office at the company in Long Island. And this was a fellow I played tennis with, you know, and it was a neighboring great man.
Okay.
Fellow named Dubin, D-U-B-I-N.
That's how you came to make this investment. You knew the man, you played tennis with him, you were leaving.
And, you know, I met him, you know, it was a great location to be. He had a great location in, near where I lived. I don't remember the exact town. I could look it up, because they're still there.
Oh.
And they're still very successful. But when I went into venture capital, I sold my shares back to the company.
Mm-hmm.
Broke even, you know, it was an investment that we talked about. I would ultimately become a 50% owner because it was a private company. He ultimately went public and made investments in other fields, particularly one that I also invested in, which manufactured pharmaceuticals or researched pharmaceuticals. And, you know, it was many years ago, and they never had any pharmaceutical
products to come out. Yeah.
However, they kept raising money. They're still raising some money at higher prices, and they've got one that's pretty close to success. And I donated all my shares to the North Shore University Hospital. I took the tax benefit. The shares are selling at a higher price now, but they still haven't completed a drug. But they have a drug. I don't know if I saved their letters. They still send me the letters. And they may hit it.
Mm. What's the name of the company?
The name of the company is Slant Fin. What's the name of the
pharmaceutical?
Didn't I give you that name?
The name may be in here, but, you know, its relationship to Slant Fin may be obscure.
Yeah, I just find it interesting that there's two pharmaceuticals that we could see, and now you mentioned a third one.
No, this is different. This is the research one.
Right, but
the research was being done in Israel.
Israeli pharmaceutical. Is that the name of the company?
It might be.
That was one that we found documentation about.
So yeah. Oh, okay. So that's interesting.
I don't think that's the same company.
Oh.
But I'll get you the name.
Okay. I'm just curious that you would get into that because you don't really have a background.
He got into it. Dubin did.
And he talked you into it.
And, you know, he was raising money for this Israeli company. And he did a lot of that sort of thing. And I joined them. I didn't make any further investments in the company because it was sort of out of my purview.
Right.
And but many people did. But it's been a very long time.
Without a return.
And I got the tax benefit of making an $80,000 gift to the hospital. And I was happy. The hospital was happy. He's still sending me stockholder reports. Maybe they never put them on the stockholder list. I don't know. But I have the name because I saved some of those reports.
One firm that we saw in the documents that was from this Geiger-Fialkov era on the West Coast that we haven't talked about before was something called Carmen Sapphire Corporation.
Carmen Sapphire. The name of the founder was Carmen. First name was, I don't remember. And at that time, I think Reagan was president, and he had a strategic defense initiative that required semiconductors built on sapphire.
Is that for to get rid of the heat or something?
It was for radiation protection.
Okay.
And I think today there is a substantial business of semiconductors on sapphire. But Sapphire Corporation was ultimately sold to Union Carbide.
Hmm.
And I think it was okay as a venture, but needed a larger company to exploit.
Was that in Southern California?
Yes.
And was it that company had a technology for making sort of synthetic
sapphire crystals?
Interesting. Was it, do you recall, if was it similar to the process for growing crystals of semiconductor materials, or was it a special?
I had to grow single crystals of sapphire, and it was a unique ability.
Mm.
There weren't too many companies doing it.
Yeah.
And we anticipated a huge demand. But that strategic defense initiative ultimately disappeared.
Right.
And there was no market, no major market for sapphire when it was sold to Union Carbide. But they felt that it had a future, and they bought it.
Right.
Union Carbide, of course, ran into some major problems in India.
Yeah.
Their own. Yeah. It's interesting because Kyocera, you know, makes these artificial synthetic sapphires, etc., synthetic these precious stones.
Yeah.
Kyocera, which is a ceramic company, so they employ that.
Substrates.
Yeah.
Electronic substrates.
But I still think that there is a government market.
There is indeed.
The semiconductor circuits built on sapphire.
I was wondering if it was for that electronic substrates or integrated circuit substrates, or I suppose you could also use it at that time for lasers, I suppose.
It never, yeah. Never became a major market, but I still think there's a government market.
There is.
Semiconductors on sapphire.
Yeah. Kind of also on the material side, but in Massachusetts rather than California, I saw a company called the Valby Corporation, if I'm saying that correct, that looked like it was making quartz or quartz devices.
We sold a company to Valby.
Oh.
Valby. I'm trying to remember what the name of the company was sold to them. They made lamps some semiconductor material that lit up. They made lamps with strings.
Hmm.
This material that lit up.
Interesting.
And it was probably some kind of LED.
Huh.
Thing. Hmm. But we had an investment in the company that made the semiconductors, and Valby acquired it for their lamp business.
I suppose at the time that must have been a very specialized.
It was.
Was it?
I don't know that I have any records of that, but I'll look. I don't know.
on the, I guess related as well to the semiconductor side was a firm called Dynalect Systems from Glenrock, New Jersey, that looked like it was making some sort of a communications device, a modem or a multiplexer or something like that.
Something like that. It turned out to be a flop.
Oh.
And just disappeared.
Mm.
It was one of our first investments. They were in New Jersey.
When you were starting out with Geiger and Fialkov, you know, very early in terms of venture capital partnerships, when you started out, did you have an expectation of what you hoped your, you know, success to failure rate for these ventures would
yes.
be, or?
We assumed the following. 30% would be successful. Like reaching a 10-to-1 return. 30% would be alive, but not worth much more. 30% would fail. We were hoping that 10% would be a big success.
Right.
Which is what made venture capital interesting.
Right.
If 1 out of 10, all you needed was 1 in your portfolio to
right.
be a major success, and it made the portfolio.
Right.
And the rest was hard work. And as it turned out, much harder than being involved in a company with varied divisions. Because if one division had trouble, it could be supported by the others. But you could have one venture company, one portfolio company help another one. So being in the venture business was tougher. But that was what we assumed. It didn't always work that way, of course. It depended upon when you invested and when you decided to liquidate. It's a big problem. The last one, which is New Light, had about 4 companies ready to go public when the recession hit. None of them went back. Well, one company went public. And the stock went from 10 to 2.
Mm.
You know, the recession was no time for that. They were the company that made fingerprint death access to computers. And they were the leading company in the field. And all the Japanese companies were their customers. But when the recession hit, nobody wanted to pay extra for fingerprint access.
Right.
And so they lost major contracts. And it's still a public company. But I think the stock is somewhere in the $2 range. And they ultimately went public at 10. And I think that New Light sold a large percentage of its portfolio at near the public price. You know, 6 months after it went public, they sold.
Mm.
So New Light did have a return on that. But what they're left with is worth very little.
Where did your expectation come from about, you know, those percentages that you were shooting for? Was it your own thinking, or was that something from investment banking, or?
It was sort of general expectation.
Common knowledge type of thing. That's what people were saying.
The whole idea of venture capital was the one big success.
Yeah.
So that this. Yeah, and you get used to failure.
Oh, you have to get used to failure. You know, I had a local bankruptcy lawyer that we worked with. We learned something about bankruptcy law. So, you can't be afraid of failure. Sometimes a failure is caused by circumstances. Sometimes, you know, your partners in the venture refuse to put more money in, you know, and a company needs more money in order to succeed, and so they let it go.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we've had companies that ultimately would have been very successful that weren't because they spent money expecting to be able to raise more, and times changed and you couldn't raise more.
Right.
You know, there are all kinds of reasons for failure.
One firm that seemed quite unlike the others was something called the National Petroleum Corporation, which seemed to be a Canadian firm. That was a Canadian oil company, or?
I think it was an American oil prospect.
Oh.
How is it that you got into that?
Geiger was interested. Foundation ownership. And you can't get there. I don't know whatever happened to it. I don't know if it was bought, the merge. I don't
remember.
It was not a success.
One that was is very well known from the history of semiconductors and computers, I guess, too, is Four-Phase, that was started by, which I guess was a Fairchild spinoff, wasn't it?
I was on the board of Four-Phase.
You were, yeah.
And they were pretty successful in creating a computer. And they sold out to Motorola. But that was after I left the company.
That they sold.
I found at one time there was on too many boards on the West Coast.
Mm.
And I just couldn't get them to hold board meetings so I can attend them on one trip, you know. And I just said, there's some of them that I just have to give up and let them go their own way.
Was that a firm that Geiger and Fialkov helped to defund Four-Phase?
I think it was Geiger and Fialkov. It was too early for Poly Ventures.
Mm, yeah.
It was one that Arthur had some interest in.
Ah.
And that's why I went into it. And it was run by a very smart fellow. I don't remember his name.
I think his name is Lee Boisel.
Lee Boisel.
He was there. I don't know what he did after it was acquired by Motorola. I'm not sure. I think in the past we talked about this firm called Micro Design in Maryland.
Yes.
That was the one that led to the semiconductor firm.
Micro Design was a group of ex-NSA people who were the best designers of computer circuitry around. The only trouble is they decided there was a company that created a computer to minimize problems in communication, which was very important for NSA.
Yes.
And so they had done it, and they did it again, but nobody wanted to pay the price. The government had to.
Right.
And
they were hoping other telecommunications companies would need it? Yeah.
They, in effect, if instead of designing a computer for that purpose, they designed a computer that Intel designed, they would have been first.
Mm.
That's life. But they sold them AMI.
Oh, I didn't realize. Oh, yeah.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, yeah, right.
We had already arranged for them to merge with Standard Resources, which was the forerunner of Standard Microsystems. And the boards had voted, but they didn't They didn't want to do business with the New York people.
Huh.
And they sold themselves to AMI, and we couldn't sell them to somebody they didn't want to be sold to. So they went to AMI.
Short of
and then we had to go find ourselves designers.
Right. An interesting looking firm to me was a place called Granger Associates in Palo Alto that seemed to be associated with this big, very well-known engineer, I take it, or John Granger or something?
John Granger, also Frederick Terman was on the board.
Oh, wow.
Who wrote the encyclopedia, you know, and I was on the board of a company in Long Island. Again, the name escapes me, I might find it, but that made antennas for airplanes.
Oh, okay.
And they merged with Granger. And no, the name of the company in Long Island was Dorn and Margolin, D-O-R-N-E. And Margolin, M-A-R-G-O-L-I-N. Arthur Dorn was the president, a friend of mine, and he invited me onto their board. I don't think I was an investor in it.
I don't know.
I went on the board because a friend asked me to be on the board, and when they merged with Granger, Arthur and I went on the Granger board.
Mm.
And as I said, it was a very interesting board. Terman was on the board. And, you know, it was a group at Stanford.
Yeah.
And I don't know what became of them because when I lessened my directorship in California, that one was not one that was part of my venture.
Mm. What was Fred Terman like? What was your impression of him?
I was very impressed. Very impressed because I had the book.
Right.
We always leave stuff. He knows from Brexit.
He had an outstanding reputation.
Yeah.
Can I just take your pen? No.
And I think I saw in my background research that I guess John Granger had been around that time the president of the IEEE. So you had some very high-powered electrical engineers in that group. Speaking of kind of well-known names, another company that you participated on the board of was, I hope I'm saying it correctly, the Benrus Corporation?
The Benrus Corporation, later the Wells Benrus Corporation.
Right.
Benrus Corporation was a watch company. A fellow that Arthur Rock went to Harvard with acquired, he and another fellow acquired the Benrus Corporation, the watch company.
Okay.
And Arthur didn't want to serve on any boards on the East Coast. So he had I and who's the other fellow? Another friend of Arthur's who was also on the Intel board. Sandy Kaplan?
Yes.
Sandy Kaplan. And I became directors of Wells, of Benrus. They later acquired a jewelry company called Wells. They changed the name to Wells Benrus Corporation. And what was the name of the important fellow?
Victor Khayyam was the...
Khayyam.
The president or the CEO or what have you, yeah.
He's deceased.
Oh, I
didn't
realize that.
But he wrote a book before he went. And he ultimately became an owner of the Patriots.
Oh, I didn't realize that.
And which was a flop for him. But Well, Ben Russ came upon some hard times. They ran through the problem. I had started a company, a personal venture company called Olive Knoll.
Yes.
Olive Knoll borrowed money and loaned it to Wells Ben Russ at very high interest rates. I think there was a period of time when the interest rates were,
Carter,
like 20%.
Carter, during Carter's time, or?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah. And Wells Ben Russ, I believe, came upon hard times after I left. But it was very successful for Olive Knoll. You know, that's where our income came from. You know, we loaned them money to expand or buy equipment or whatever. And they didn't make it in the watch business. Mm. They made good watches. They sold a lot to the government. And it was a well-known name, a brand name that was well-known. But they didn't make good watches after, you know, that they could sell at high prices. Mm. So it was just an also watch company. And I don't know what became of it. They used to have a box at the Tennis Open every year with their big name on the clock over the Tennis Open. And I enjoyed the tennis. And they were in Connecticut. And I stayed with it as long as it made sense. And Victor sent me a sword for performance above the call of duty. I still have it hanging up in my house. In the closet.
But they were selling to the government some military watches or something like
they
that.
They sold military watches, but they also sold regular watches.
They tried to be a
major watch company. They were when they were acquired.
Okay.
But they didn't sell the high end.
Oh no.
No. They didn't have a name that came from Switzerland.
Yeah, I've never heard of them, that's why.
It's interesting.
I think Ben and Russ were the names of the original founders.
Oh.
And, you know, I went to board meetings regularly in Connecticut. Wells was a jewelry company in... I think it was in Rhode Island, on the pathway between Rhode Island and Massachusetts. I'm trying to name it the name of the town, Attleboro?
Yeah, right.
Attleboro. That's where they were.
Later into the 70s, I saw a reference to something called the Codi Corporation, the CODI. Corporation
Codi,
that seemed to be a semiconductor outfit.
Codi was a diode rectifier company in New Jersey that I took a position in. It was a public company. I took a position in and went on the board. And my recollection is that they continued to be small and did well. And why I left, I don't know. And I don't know what happened to them after I left.
Do you think in these different board experiences that you had, was there a common thing that you felt that you would bring to the board, or was it different for each case?
I always felt that I could bring a great deal to the board because I knew so much. I had so much experience.
Right.
And one person can usually move the board in the right direction. Mm. And if you cannot, you know, there's no sense staying. And I found that my partner at New Light was never able to move a board in the right direction. And he went along with what the other board members wanted to do, which was not good. I had some bad experiences there. But you have to be a loud voice on a board.
Did you find yourself often at odds with other directors, or were you just kind of the outspoken person?
I was the outspoken guy.
And so you would be framing the discussion in a way, and...
But sometimes it didn't work. For instance, two companies in particular that I was involved in. One was called Globecom. It's a public company.
Yeah.
The other one is called Primus.
Yes.
Telecommunications, another public company. Globecom had a rise to about $50 a share, no, $40 a share, from after going public at a very small amount, and decided to raise some money. By the time it was raising money, the stock was selling at around 32. Hmm. And I was on the committee, on the pricing committee. And it came back to them, the underwriter came back to them, and said, we can't sell it at 32, we can sell it at 27. And everybody else on the committee said, oh, we can't do it at 27. I said, take the money. All right, they took the money, and it let them survive through many unprofitable years, and now they're profitable, doing about $200,000 a year. And they're a profitable company.
Mm.
I tried the same thing at Primus. Primus was able to raise $1 billion, but mostly debt.
Mm.
I said, sell equity. They don't want to get. They don't want to get.
Diluted or something.
You know, depreciated out or whatever.
Oh yeah, yeah.
No. They can sell all the debt they wanted. They grew to doing over $1 billion a year. But then hard times hit, and they went bankrupt.
Mm.
Because they couldn't pay the interest. That's two stories that I tell boards now. Still, sell equity, not debt.
Mm.
You can raise money, sell equity.
Because it's fundamentally less risky to the firm?
You know, you never know what's going to happen in the future.
Right.
You know, all you need is one bad year, and the banks pull in, and you're dead.
Mm.
Been through that.
With which, or with your experience with all these different firms, you've seen that time and again. To go back to those firms that you were involved with in the later 70s, another one that I saw was called Computer Instruments Corporation, which I think Hempstead, New York, that's Long Island, isn't it?
That was a friend of mine asked me to go on the board. They were a small company, doing well. I went on the board, but it was, you know, because a friend asked me. I don't think I had a position in it. And I was on the board for a number of years. It was a public company.
Yeah.
And as far as I know, it was still a small company doing well when I left.
One of the last names that I saw from the from the later 70s was something called Entertainment Systems Incorporated that I think was in Florida.
Entertainment Systems, and what did they do? I remember the name very well.
Yeah.
I remember it because it was the only company that the SEC examined me on for some reason. I don't remember what they did. I'll find out. I think the fellow sold stock privately. Ran into some trouble with the SEC.
In this era, when you were taking stocks public, which exchange were you working with? The American Stock Exchange, New York Stock Exchange?
Mostly over the counter.
Over the counter. And I guess I'm not quite sure.
I think Ben Ross was on the American Stock Exchange.
Yeah.
But it was mostly over the counter. You didn't have to be on an exchange anymore.
Okay. And was there, I guess something I'll have to look into a bit more. I'm not quite sure that I understand how the trades in over-the-counter stocks work. Is there a central area where you can find out what these things are trading at, the different securities?
Or? Find out in a minute. You call your broker and he'll tell you how many shares are offered at what price.
Okay. Yeah, so there is
it's a very... It's a very good market.
Is there a central organizing?
NASDAQ,
yeah.
Yeah.
And
those that are listed, you know, that are qualified to be listed on NASDAQ,
right.
But there's a lot of over-the-counter stocks that are not. They call them the pink sheets.
It's still handled through the mechanism of NASDAQ, these trades?
No, they're not. They're handled through people who specialize in trading them.
So there are brokers who do that.
There are people who do that.
Yeah.
I mean, just like specialists work.
Sure.
On the New York and American, there are people who just do it on their own.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Used to visit them, and you used to see all their information on the board, and you saw what was going on.
And how has that diminished over time, or what's your impression
no,
of that?
No, because there has to be a mechanism for trading stocks that are delisted, because there are no longer qualified for NASDAQ.
Mm-hmm.
NASDAQ has hard rules. And if they're delisted, people still want to buy and sell.
And so there are some firms that would be like market makers and you know, investment houses that would have a market for these stocks.
There are some large investment houses that have small groups doing that.
I see. I understand now. And so that's been a consistent important. There's been a consistent important role for that over time.
It has to be.
Is it also an important place for, you know, not just when a stock is delisted for whatever reason, but also for, you know, new ventures? Is it important?
New
for
ventures
them?
Went on NASDAQ when they went public.
Yeah.
It was very important to be listed. You didn't want to be on the pink sheets. Pink sheets were the companies that were no longer qualified by the rules that NASDAQ insisted on.
Right. Okay.
Um,
let's see. I guess keeping with the, in the semiconductor vein, I saw, well, let's say just by the, when you closed Geiger and Fialkov in the later 70s, was, how did it shake out in terms of those percentages that we had been talking about before? Do you think you had 10% that were the real high flyers?
Well, we made a lot of money on Intel.
Yeah.
Standard Microsystem was Geiger and Fialkov.
Right.
That was a winner.
Right.
And another winner was Microsemi.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we had already sold Intel. But the companies, I think there were five companies that we distributed to the partners. Microsemi was one of them.
Mm.
We had a lot of that. And Standard Microsystems. I'm trying to remember what the others were.
Was Teledyne one of the...
No, Teledyne was a personal investment for me.
Oh, okay, I didn't realize that.
That I bought at a certain price and sold at a certain price higher. That was before Geiger and Fialkov.
I understand.
That was, you know, I was investing with Arthur.
Right.
But Microsemi did very well in time. Those who held on to it did very well. Still a very good company.
Some of the firms I saw mentioned from the period of the early 1980s, one was Three Dimensional Circuits, which I think was a...
It was a printed circuit board manufacturer.
Okay.
They got into trouble. They were polluting the ground. And they wound up bankrupt.
Mm.
A company that I went on, invested in because a former friend of mine, a former partner of mine in General Transistor, was a major owner. And they just had poor management. The controller was stupid. The president was stupid.
To let that pollution go on.
You know, they weren't the only company making printed circuit boards that were polluting. But they got into bad trouble.
How is it that they weren't the only ones, but how is it that they were the one of the few that got caught?
I don't remember. They made good printed circuit boards, but they didn't follow the rules in getting rid of their bad chemicals.
Right. How about Princeton Sensors? That was a company I saw listed.
That's Princeton Sensors was one I think I once told you about, but hadn't remembered the name.
Oh.
They made something that you would put into the smokestacks of utilities and let you know when you were operating inefficiently.
Okay. Yes, I do recall that.
And the utilities were making all the money they wanted without spending money on capital.
Mm-hmm.
Now, of course, the time has come where that's probably a good market. But then it wasn't.
Mm.
Of course, they were polluting. They knew they were polluting. They knew they were not operating efficiently. But they asked for increases in rates. They got increases in rates. They didn't want to spend money they didn't have to spend.
Hmm. And so eventually that company faded out.
Faded out. Their market did develop. They had an excellent product. It told them, you know, when there was a certain amount of carbon monoxide or dioxide being wasted.
Right.
And nobody wanted it.
What was your motive in investing in this company? Was it because you felt that...
There was another venture capitalist named Horace Shepherd.
Okay.
And he liked it. And I liked Hardy, and I went into it. I mean, they had an excellent product and an excellent product market, except that it wasn't a market.
I mean, the market existed in theory, but not in fact. And you didn't go in there thinking that this was a socially responsible sort of... investment.
No.
Your friend was in there.
It was increasing the efficiency
right.
of the fuel you were using.
Right, so that's socially responsible, but I mean, you didn't.
Yeah, that wasn't the purpose.
No.
It wasn't a green thing.
Yeah.
It was just a sensible thing.
Right. And you thought it would make money.
Yeah. A huge market.
And then you found out it really wasn't there.
That's right.
Timing
is very important.
Right. Same thing might be said about the generic drugs. I mean, the timing wasn't right. Here again, the timing wasn't right. But the underlying idea was a good one.
Yeah. You have to be lucky, too.
Well, you get lucky 1 out of 10 times, you're doing well.
That's right.
A quite different sounding firm was, I guess from a little bit later in the 80s, was Barasini Foods.
Which?
Barasini or...
Oh, Barasini Foods.
Barasini Foods, yeah.
Somebody I met... was in the candy business, and Barasini Foods was available for acquisition. And he convinced me that the two of us should buy it and become partners.
This was a friend of yours or just a guy you know?
Somebody I met. You know, you went into the monthly meetings at Long Island Venture Capital or whatever, and you met people. And he was an impressive guy. He knew what he was doing. And it was a brand name that was very well known to me. Mm-hmm. And I said, he said, here's an opportunity to own this brand name and just, you know, like a cash cow.
Right.
And so we bought Barasini Foods. Then we found a group of people who had once been, I don't know what you would call them, hippies or something, that started their own farm down south and making products. And they started making tofu-based desserts.
And this was in the 70s as well, right?
This is in the 80s, I think.
1980s, okay.
And I think there was a company doing that called Tofuti.
Yeah.
And this would be competing with them. And it turned out to be a tough business because you had to buy space in the supermarket frozen section.
Mm.
So you had a capital to do it. But Barasini had a name, which was better than Tofuti. And so we competed with Tofuti for a while. And the candy business was, we licensed it out, and we were getting licensing fees, and we were doing well. But the tofu business became very difficult because Tofuti became experts at making deals to get space, and that was what made success or failure in the grocery business. And we ultimately sold Barasini Foods. It's still a public company, by the way. And I had given all my stock. I had sold all my stock to my son-in-law as a tax loss. So he's a major stockholder.
Is he doing well? Is he doing well with that stock?
Barasini was not doing well, so it was a tax loss. I sold it.
I know, but now it did.
Ultimately, there was a group who wanted to buy it. And it was sold to a company called Hain Foods, H-A-I-N, which is a successful public company now. And the Barasini Foods shareholders and debtors got stock in Hain Foods, which we promptly sold because it was cash. Should have held on to it, because Hain Foods has been a major acquirer of firms in the business. And it's a well-known public company. They make tea, for instance, now. And they acquired a company making various teas. And so I got some stock in Hain Foods and sold it. And so did most everybody else. But Barasini Foods did not sell its public company, so it became a shell corporation. And my son-in-law trying to find a partner to merge with it, and hasn't been successful. It still has some cash, and I think they're just dissolving it. But it actually was sold, so the shareholders did wind up with something good.
This was a company that you went into. This was an area you're not that knowledgeable about.
Not knowledgeable at all, but except I knew the brand.
Right.
There are two brands in the candy business, Barton's and Barasini.
Right.
And I thought, let's see what happens. And if we just kept getting license fees for the candy business, we would have had a cash cow.
Right.
But my partner decided we want to get into this tofu business, and it was a tough business.
Do you feel it went down that road because you weren't familiar enough with that area? And
I learned later about what it costs to sell frozen foods.
Right.
To get space in the frozen foods section. You have to pay a lot of money.
So neither of you really knew that business at all?
No. He just knew the candy business.
I'm just wondering if there's a lesson out of that. In other words, stick to what you know.
But there's still Barasini ice cream being sold, Barasini candy being sold.
Yeah.
More closely connected to your experience with high technology was a firm called General Ceramics that seemed to make some sort of exotic ceramics.
General Ceramics was a company well known in the field that was in the ceramic business, and there was a fellow on Wall Street, his name escaped me for the moment, whom I knew, and he wanted me to be on the board, so I made an investment in it. And it succeeded. You know, it was a very successful company, and it was sold to the Japanese ultimately.
Hmm. Kyocera?
Who?
To Kyocera? Kyocera? Kyocera Company?
I think so.
So it was eventually sold to them?
Yeah.
Was that for?
And that was profitable. It was a profitable investment.
Where was that company located?
In New Jersey.
Okay. Do you remember what part of New Jersey?
I don't have that in mind.
It was northern New Jersey. I used to go there often. I don't remember the town.
Because it was a ceramics business in Frenchtown, which is
well-known ceramic business,
which was close to where you used to live.
Yeah. It seems that was that for general use of industrial use of ceramics, or were they in the semiconductor world also?
Both.
Then I saw a listing of Geotel, which I think was in satellite telecommunication work.
Geotel is another sad story. Was a successful company, public company, that apparently fell on hard times for two reasons. One is the fellow who was running it was a pretty smart guy, you know, but again, he went into debt with the banks. And their controller started playing the stock market with the company's funds and lost about $1 million.
Oh my gosh.
Finally wound up in jail. And the Geotel survived that because the fellow was running it, had good relationships with the banks, and was able to borrow money. But he ran into a major problem because he went into a new business that provided employees. And this was a business where you paid the employees immediately, but the people to whom you sold them paid you in 60, 90, or 120 days. So the faster you grew, the faster you got in trouble. The banks closed it. He became the dean of the business school at Long Island University in Long Island. The dean of the business. But again, borrowing doesn't belong in a venture business.
And you invested in Geotel, or you were just
I invested.
And you had confidence in this guy who was running the company, I guess.
Yeah. It was a successful company. And they had the controller, you know, a terrible thing.
Well, in this must have venture.
He must have borrowed some money and then got into trouble. He figured he would invest the company's fund. The bank required two signatures. They gave him money with one signature.
Mm-hmm.
There's lots of reasons for failure.
No, but it's interesting, and also this new business they went into, providing employees.
Yeah.
So I can imagine how that works. You're paying these people, they go to work for someone else.
Right.
And then 180 days later, you get the money back.
Right.
That seems like a formula for failure, right?
The faster you grow, the faster you run out of money.
Yeah.
So unless he thought he could, he thought he had, you know, receivables.
Right.
He was really factoring his receivables.
Right.
It didn't work. The fellow who was running that department ultimately is running a successful business doing that.
Oh, really?
No.
Did he change the rules by which it worked, or
he just has
enough capital to make it happen?
He's a fellow named Szczynski. And I see him once in a while. He's doing well.
Let me just stop the tape.